At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The Angry Birds movie, electronic music, and, of course, the 5 days gone by. Sounds like a show to me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday the 20th of May. Good as always to have you here, everybody. I know I said this last week, but seriously, here's the deal. It's entirely possible that I'm going to be saying it from now until the 8th of November. We have landed firmly at that point where the politics of the presidential campaign bump up against economic reality. David Gura at Bloomberg and Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post are the lucky winners of our weekly, hey, you want to come on the show? Phone calls. They, thankfully for us, said yes.
It was an email, actually.
It was an email.
Always easy on a Friday.
Never tell the host anything. Whatever. So, Catherine, here's the deal. You get to go first today. Donald Trump was giving a speech last night at a fundraiser for Chris Christie, and he gave a standard stump speech, and then he went off script a little bit and said, this, talking about international trade. Here you go.
And these dummies say, that's a trade war. Trade war? We're losing $500 billion in trade with China. Who the hell cares if there's a trade war? Trade war.
So, Catherine, you care?
Yes, definitely. Right. As should the millions of Americans whose jobs are related to exporting. Whose jobs will be at risk, as should all of the other Americans who are working in industries that are connected to those industries, as we have this sort of death spiral where our trade partners retaliate with their own tariffs. You have people laid off here. That reduces how much they can spend. That reduces, the demand for other firms' goods and services, things like that. I mean, there's a reason why this is the kind of thing that keeps economists up at night, which is that when you have a trade war, it has tremendous consequences that ripple throughout the economy.
Economist and business journalist, too, I would say. Mr. Gura, you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the most animated sounding political fundraiser I've ever heard with screaming and yelling, hooping and hollering at the end there. So you mentioned he went off script. I'm not sure how much he was on script, but this is something he said over and over again. I mean, if I had a nickel for every time he mentioned the carrier company sending jobs to Mexico, I could build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Hey now.
This is stuff that his supporters are really rallying behind. He mentioned last night that it's the only thing that Bernie Sanders and he agree on, and Bernie Sanders is on to something because of it. But Catherine's own newspaper, The Washington Post, looked at this and found out that if the policies that Donald Trump is proposing here, repealing NAFTA, putting a 35% tariff on goods produced overseas, happened, we'd see a recession not only in countries like China and Mexico. We'd have a recession here as well. So, we should be worried about it. Serious consequences.
All right. To the other side of the political aisle, I guess, if you will. The overtime rules, Catherine, that the White House put out this week, Department of Labor, I guess, specifically, got a lot of press, and it will make a difference in some people's lives. Give me the big picture equation, though. How much will this really matter?
I think we don't entirely know at this point. There are a lot of workers whom it could help because they'll be entitled to more pay if they work more hours. you know, I am a little bit worried that there are workers who will be hurt by it, in that it's basically incentivizing employers to hire more people on a part-time basis so that they don't have to trip more workers into that overtime category. So I think that when I've talked to economists about this, they have sort of mixed reactions, and we'll have to see. It's a bit of an experiment.
David, thoughts?
Yeah, I think studies have been shown that this is going to affect young workers especially. And, you know, the qualification here doubles to $47,000-something,
and
it's the first time we've seen this go up in more than a decade. So as Catherine says, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, there are a lot of young people here who could use a little more money in their pockets. Yeah.
David, the corporate story, well, one of the corporate stories of the week, the corporate sales story is Yahoo. It's on the block. They're taking offers. The price tag had been plus or minus $4 billion. But it turns out, the Journal reports today, numbers are coming in a lot below that. $2 billion, $3 billion. What's going on with this company, and can anything save it?
Yeah, I think analysts were saying it could be worth as much as $8 billion, the core assets of that company. You had Warren Buffett and Dan Gilbert expressing some interest in it as well, and I gather there's going to be another round of sort of bids coming in here in a couple of weeks. But I think people don't really know how much this is worth. A lot of companies interested in this from a variety of places. Again, I'll bring up Buffett again, getting into game here.
Yeah.
But just pinpointing that valuation, I think, will continue to be difficult going forward.
All right, we got a boogie. Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post and David Gura at Bloomberg. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, be good. Wall Street this week was a tad choppy, kind of rough, a little bumpy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Egyptian and French officials are still trying to figure out exactly what happened to Egypt Air Flight 804 yesterday. Debris has apparently been found in the Mediterranean Sea. The search area has been narrowed accordingly. In Egypt, meanwhile, where tourism accounts for 11% of gross domestic product, that industry is bracing for more of a hit. Since the revolution in 2011, multiple and often violent changes of government, threats of terrorism, and now two airplane explosions are keeping tourists away. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Ongoing political turmoil and negative press aren't the only things keeping visitors away. Mohamed El Fouli runs the tour company Matigi, based in Cairo. He says even once you get tourists to Egypt, it's getting harder to show them a good time.
When you go to a place that's hugely packed with people from all over the world, and you would go there and you'd find yourself the only occupied room in the hotel, it's pretty depressing.
El Fouli's business has shifted to mostly domestic and eco-tourism, which is still a struggle. Helen Morano is with the World Travel and Tourism Council, which looks at the economic impact of global tourism. She says since the revolution, Egypt has lost about 30% of its tourists.
It's 11% of their employment, or 2.6 million directly employed in this industry for them. So it is a substantial core of their economic well-being.
And she says while global tourism is doing just fine, tourism to Egypt is down about 50% in the first couple of months of the year. Stephen Cook is with the Council on Foreign Relations and is in Egypt now. He flew in on Wednesday on the very same plane that crashed.
As soon as I came in and saw friends, they were seeing how optimistic they were that the tourists would start coming back.
But within a few hours, as news of the crash spread, that optimism vanished. Cook says with dangerously low foreign currency reserves and over 100 shuttered hotels and thousands of lost jobs, Egypt really needed a good tourism season this year.
The reverberations are going to go on for quite some time. It's another blow, and you have to wonder how many more blows the Egyptians can take.
In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Okay, so how is this for a credit card balance? Almost $1 trillion. The Federal Reserve says our collective outstanding balances climbed to more than $951 billion at the beginning of this year. And yes, we as a people do like to buy things, but also banks are making it easier for us to get our hands on those pieces of plastic. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
It was a long struggle, but finally 2 months ago, 35-year-old David Anderson of Cleveland and his wife Kristen paid off their credit card balance, which at one point was as high as $8,000. Anderson says the bank just kept raising their credit limit.
And it happened again and again and again.
Finally, Anderson says his wife asked the bank to lower their credit limit. to $4,000.
Which they balked and argued with us a little bit. Just prying questions, you know, why?
Sounds like the easy credit we were able to get before the financial crisis. And banks are pushing plastic to subprime consumers again, too. But James Chesson says the growth of credit cards is a good thing. He's chief economist at the American Bankers Association. He says it's a sign of consumer confidence, driving a growing economy.
Consumers are feeling better about their financial situation and are looking to buy that refrigerator and a couch that they may have put off before.
But banks haven't completely opened the credit card spigot, according to Brian Riley with the business advisory firm CEB. He says you have to jump through a few more hoops now to get a credit card. The bank checks your income, for example. I asked Riley, does that mean banks have learned from the financial crisis?
I don't think we've learned all the lessons we need to. I mean, certainly when you do hit subprime, what's the magic number of giving somebody so much debt they can't handle?
Riley says it's good banks are doing an income check, but what happens if subprime customers lose their jobs, like in another financial crisis? In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
A bunch of you wrote to us to say how much your credit card limits have risen recently, as much as 300% in at least one example. You can read all the responses we get at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
Why are these birds so angry?
I don't know, but they clearly are. Angry Birds, the movie. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 65 points today, 0.3%, ended at 17,500 on the nose. The NASDAQ added 57 points, 1.2%, 4,769. The S&P 500 up 12 points, 0.6%, 2,052. For the week, the Dow and the S&P basically unchanged. The NASDAQ up 0.1%. Might as well not even have bothered, huh? Remco Gershenson Properties Trust. Yeah, you say that 10 times fast. It owns shopping centers, including Olentangy Plaza in Ohio and Nagawaki Center in Wisconsin. Ha! Up 1.2% today. Lam Research Corporation, which is a supplier of wafer fabrication equipment, up 4.5%. Vico Instruments, which makes thin film equipment for electronics, gained 5% today. KLA Tencor, which serves semiconductor makers, up 0.25%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.84%. Come on, you gotta have fun doing this. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There are some big changes coming to those little nutrition labels you see on packaged food and drinks. New rules on same were announced today by the Food and Drug Administration. Not only will the kinds of information change, but so too will how that information is presented change. Calorie counts per serving, for instance, will now appear in a giant font. Probably the biggest change, though, is what the labels will now tell you about how much sweetener has been added to a product in the form of high fructose corn syrup or sugar or even honey, as it turns out. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has the details.
A lot of foods and beverages have sweeteners added to them, more than you might think.
There are added sugars in jams, in breads, in cereals, in condiments.
Jim O'Hara is with the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which advocated for the label changes. The revised nutrition facts labels will show how many of the grams of sugar in a product have been added in and the share of the daily amount of added sugars that the government finds suitable.
For instance, a 20-ounce Coke has 130% of the daily value of added sugar.
The FDA says soda, sports drinks, and desserts are among the biggest sources of added sugars. A major industry group representing food and beverage companies didn't exactly denounce the new rules. Candy maker Mars actually welcomed them. Food marketing expert John Stanton says big companies have already been reformulating products to use less sugar. In today's health world, sugar is the new fat, the maligned ingredient.
The manufacturers, the Coca-Colas of the world, are going to find other solutions.
Stanton thinks sugar processors will suffer most because their product is getting demonized. Courtney Gain is head of the Sugar Association. She fears the revised nutrition facts panels will label foods as good or bad.
Consumers are now going to have added sugars front of mind at point of purchase.
Big food and beverage companies have 2 years to comply with the label changes. Smaller firms have 3 years. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
When you talk electronic music synthesizers, there's really only one name you need to know: Bob Moog. It's spelled Moog, it's pronounced Moog. Back in the 1960s, he started making electronic musical instruments, and now, more than a decade after he died, Moog Music is going strong. The company even has its own festival, the vaguely South by Southwest-like Moog Fest, which is going on right now in Durham, North Carolina. Mike Adams is the president and CEO of Moog Music. Mike, thanks for coming on the program.
Great to be here.
Tell me, first of all, would you, about Bob Moog, the guy?
Well, Bob was obviously a genius. He was an engineer's engineer, typical kind of nerd. always had the pocket protector, 10 pens, three of them were leaking, you know, that kind of thing. He called himself a tool maker for musicians, and I think that's a really good description of him. But maybe he's maybe a little bit more than that.
For all the vision that he had, though, about engineering and music together, he was not a great businessman.
That's a widely held perception. He would probably say he was not a great businessman, but he made a lot of decisions that let me give you one in particular.
Sure.
In the 60s, 62 or 64 maybe, he hired a publicist in New York that he paid $25,000 a year.
Ooh.
And
in the
he wanted, yeah, that's a lot of money back then. And the goal was to make Moog synonymous with synthesizers. And to this day,
yeah, well,
you pick up a New York Times crossword puzzle, you know, four-letter word for synthesizer, you know what it is. So,
if you had to describe this company and its products to somebody who was unfamiliar, how would you do it?
Well, I mean, very simply, we make electronic musical instruments, primarily a synthesizer. And a synthesizer is a device that you can program, if you will. I don't like that term, but you can twist some knobs around and make it sound just like any instrument that you want. It's a creative tool that all artists can unleash what's in their mind and make it happen on a synthesizer.
When you hear electronic music, can you tell whether it's Moog or not?
Most of the time, if it's our stuff, I can definitely hear it. I'm not a musician per se, but you know, I've been around it so long now that, you know, I definitely can hear if it's an analog synthesizer for sure. I can tell you that.
All right. Well, let me run you through a couple, and maybe you can talk me through it. So we have some sound in the control room, and this is a demo that you put together for one of the apps that you have. Let's roll a little bit of that.
Definitely a Moog drone. Yep.
So you said something there right as it started rolling. Definitely
very
a Moog
classic
one.
Moog drone sound with some noise and added white noise to it and the typical buildup, the filter cut off. Mm-hmm. I can hear all that in that particular piece.
Wow.
There.
Which is cool because I heard, you know, I don't even know what I heard. I don't have the vocabulary to describe that. All right. So all right. So here's, this is the System 55 demo. This is the big boy, right?
Right.
So here's the question. Does it take skill to play this thing?
Oh, gosh, yes. To make it, you know, musical like that, that you just heard, that's pleasing and, you know, other people want to listen to it. No question that it takes some skills and there's some people that can do some incredible things with it.
Do you think as this company goes forward into the increasing digital future, it's going to be able to keep going with the actual hardware, or are you going to have to eventually, of necessity, turn to the iPads and the iPhones and the places where you can have these apps where you can carry it around in your back pocket?
Well, we've come through that period a little bit. When I first started, everybody was gaga about software this and software that. Mm-hmm. Everything was done on a computer, and we've sort of crossed that chasm. Actually, it's kind of interesting. 2008 was when I noticed it changed, and I talked to our distributor in France about it. He says, "Yeah, you know, everybody realizes that when the economy tanked, all their software wasn't worth anything, but all their hardware was still very valuable." And so they started from just an investment standpoint, the hardware was more valuable. But that's not the real issue. The real issue is musicians want that tactile feedback. They want that keyboard. They want to twist that knob. Mm-hmm. They want to flip that switch. They want to move the dials around. And On the flip side, young people who don't have any money have to get into it from a software standpoint.
I mean, I can spend $30 on an app and be in business, right?
Exactly, right.
Mike Adams is the president and CEO of Moog Music. Mike, thanks very much for your time.
Great, Kai. Thank you.
When you think about Hollywood directors, maybe what you conjure up is Spielberg or somebody like that framing the perfect shot, right? Just classic stuff. What if instead I tell you that what we're talking about is somebody bringing their unique cinematic vision to a bunch of cartoon birds slingshotting through the air, trying for some reason to hit green pigs? The Angry Birds movie, based, yes, on the game, opens this weekend amid predictions that it's going to top the box office. So, with animation becoming a bigger part of the movie industry, Marketplace's Adrian Hill examines the animation director's job frame by frame.
It's a pivotal scene. Near the end of the Angry Birds movie, the birds fly for the very first time.
Remember, the goal is the castle. Get to the castle. Who wants to go first?
Over here.
I do.
Considering its significance to the plot and the audience, you might expect this scene would be fully fleshed out in the script. Pages of dialogue, direction.
It was just a line, the birds start firing into Pig City and the action begins.
That's Fergal Reilly. He directed the movie along with Clay Cadis. The challenge of creating that moment, says Reilly.
The audience is going to expect the slingshot and the birds getting fired in to rescue their eggs and knock over buildings.
It's the essence of the game, the most predictable part of the story.
So how do we just blow their minds and make it really cinematic?
So they started where all good directors start, with motivation. Who are these birds? What's their backstory?
Why are these birds so angry?
After they delved deep into the psyches of their avian stars, they knew the flying scene could only belong to Matilda. She's the white bird.
She's been a zen hen up to this point, but now that sort of buried thread of anger that's sort of like just kind of bubbling beneath the surface, it comes right out.
But you still got to bring it to life.
And really behind every single little part of a moment that you see on screen is an amazing team of creative artists.
Writers, story artists, animators, people who light the scenes, do the visual effects. They obsessed over every detail of the launch scene.
Fire! The way the camera moves, you know, rakes across Matilda as she, you know, as she flies through the air. The amount of fizz that comes out of Matilda's butt, you know, how explosive that egg is.
And how exactly that should sound.
It's got a lot of fear in it. It's got a lot of excitement.
Reilly says actress Maya Rudolph, who plays Matilda, took and retook that yell.
As many as Maya could withstand without losing her voice screaming.
These are what's known in the animation world as efforts.
Which are non-dialogue sounds that come from the character. Everything from like, you know, sort of stretching back, you know, like the, you know, to the actual screams that they would make as they sailed through the air.
They're usually natural in live action films. A person groans when they lift a chair because they're lifting a chair.
But in animation, it's totally artificially created. So we have to describe each of those to the actor.
Animation directors are basically gods of their world. They control the way the wind blows, the angle of the sun, the way a hat flies off a character's head.
The great thing about animation is it's iterative. So at every stage, you have the opportunity to find more magic.
But those opportunities can tank an animation budget. Big rethinks late in the process, and it's back to the drawing board. Reilly says Angry Birds, which reportedly cost about $80 million, took only a couple years to make, relatively quick by animation standards. And when you see the launch scene, you start to understand the time and work that went into it, building out that one line in the script.
I just love the idea that you can world build, especially with today's technology, you can create anything that you can imagine.
including a dry-witted red bird with big black eyebrows making a butt joke.
Huh, she can shoot fireballs out of her butt.
It looks spontaneous, but it's actually completely artificially created and thought about for months and months by dozens of people.
Because that's how you make a movie. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
This final note today, which comes with the following caveat. A couple of years ago, also on a Friday, as it happens, I made a joke about how that day was going to be my last day hosting this program because I had discovered a company that had Beer Cart Friday every Friday afternoon. The boss came by with a beer cart and gave out free beer. What's not to like, right? Of course I'll take that job. Well, let's just say not everybody realized I was kidding, and I got something of a talking to, something of a stern talking to, if I'm being honest. So to repeat, this is not that. But if it were, this is how it would go. I would announce that this was my last day at Marketplace because there's a company in North Carolina that's going to give its employees brand new Tesla Model 3s. It's called Practicum. It makes scientific instruments, and the CEO says the Tesla thing is good and cost-effective recruiting. So sign me up, but don't, because I'm kidding. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. True story, by the way. I got a phone call Friday night at home asking me what the heck I had done. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 65 points today, 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 up 12 points, 0.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. We are going to be back here on Monday. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.